So I've titled this Stress in the Female Brain. But you male brains best listen up. Because the male brain tends to routinely underestimate stressors, which actually then can put additional stress on their female girlfriends, partners, wife, whatever, because it's the law of, you know, push and pull. So the male who underestimates the consequences of a stressor and he's pulling back, well, she's doing the same thing the other way and it becomes even worse for her. And so now we have a lose-lose situation instead of a win-win. So let me share with you some information tonight that has not been out for very long and certainly has made a difference in my life. So, just a fast overview of a few things about stressors so that we're sure we're all on the same page. So there are three generally recognized stress categories, and I'm sure most of you already know that. First of all, when people come up to me and say, oh, if I could just get the stress out of my life, I go, maybe not, because the absence of stress is death. When the brain and body can no longer respond to requests for change, your history. And I have no desire to go down that path any sooner than I absolutely have to. But there are three types of stressors, three categories of stressors. The first one is called eustress. And it's stress, but when you participate in choosing to do that event or situation, you don't have the negative consequences that the other two categories give you. So I'm under stress right now, standing up here and talking to you about stress, because public speaking, at least in the United States, is the number one fear of most people. It even beats out flying. But I chose to do this, and so I'm really not getting any negative outcomes from it, although it is more stressful for me than for you. The second type is distress, and that's outright negative stress, that if you've got the choice, you'd avoid it. Last August 2014, we had the Napa earthquake, and I have no idea if you heard about that in Australia, but the epicenter, 7.1, was 3 miles from my house. So it pretty well trashed everything in the house. That's distress. And it does have negative consequences if you don't know how to manage stressors. And the third category is mistress. And notice how it's spelled, M-I-S-S-T-R-E-S-S. I point that out because often when I'm lecturing and I say the third category is mistress, you can be sure that some woman is going to say, I know all about that. My husband has had several of them. And I point out that if your husband has a mistress, it's probably distress, not mistress. Mistress is hidden stress, long commutes, sitting in front of a computer screen, and not getting up every 30 minutes to have a couple minutes of really good physical exercise to compensate for the sitting. Unmanaged distress and mistress actually kill brain cells. And that's a very scary thought. And the brain organ that's most susceptible to damage from stress is called the hippocampus. It's in that middle mammalian layer of the brain. If you think of my left wrist as the first brain layer, my left fist as the second brain layer, now you put your other hand over the top of that fist. If you could move that right into the brain, that would basically be the three brain layers. First brain layer is the reptilian brain, because that's all reptiles have. The second layer is the mammalian brain, because that's what mammals have, and we, of course, are mammals. And in that second layer, which is not very large, is the hippocampus, which is your brain's search engine, just like the search engine on your computer. And when you want to remember something or locate information in your brain, that hippocampus starts searching, just like the search engine on your computer, looking for that bit of information. It is the most sensitive to stressors. So it can actually start killing cells in the hippocampus, and you want to remember something and can't find it because the cells that would have found that are not working. And it's not pretty. Alzheimer's affects that middle layer as well. And certainly the other parts of the immune system in the body and so on can be negatively impacted by stressors as well. So when you look at this cutaway of the brain, you can actually see those three layers. So the brainstem and the cerebellum would be my left wrist. It's that first layer, only subconscious thought. This middle part in here, can you see that sort of curved little whitish part? That represents the corpus callosum, that largest connector of the two, between the two hemispheres. That's the mammalian layer. And then you've got this rind on the watermelon, so to speak, which is the neocortex or gray matter or cerebrum, lots of names for it. So stress is a very relative concept. You can take 100 people and subject them to the same event, and there will be a whole range of whether or not that is stressful for that brain. You know, some things that are stressful for one brain are just a piece of cake for another one, and actually helps them to feel really energized and alive and stimulated and so on. Every brain on the planet being unique means that every brain on the planet has a slightly different perception about what a stressor means to it and how to deal with it. Remember that every thought you think changes your brain. And because none of us think the same thoughts, our brains actually become more different as we get older. So the stress responses are typically learned, and you start that in childhood. How do your caregivers, how do your parents, how do your teachers manage stressors? And that's how you begin to develop your stress responses. And if they're flying off the wall all the time with stressors, then you probably have not learned really good stress management techniques. Effective stress management relates to two things: your perception of what this really means and how bad it is or how good it is, and how flexible you are. So the less flexible you are, the more difficulty you're going to have with stressors, because the brain works best in a flexible environment. You know, there's always another way to shoe the horse. You know, it doesn't have to be just one way. And we create probably, according to some researchers, at least 50% of our own stress simply because of the way we think. Because if you believe there is only one way to shoe a horse and you see somebody else doing it differently, then that's going to be a stressor for you. And depending on your personality, you may try to get them to shoe the horse differently and have some conflict, and it's not going to be pretty. But the good news is, since we learn our stress response, you can unlearn them or relearn them if it would be more effective for you. So all human brains need good stress management techniques, and I'm not going to spend any time on that except later to give you my number one stress management technique. Because if you don't have any good techniques, then you're going to have some negative outcomes from the stress. However, why don't you read this slide with me? How many of you are reading 10 minutes a day? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Well, that's better than this morning. Some of you must have gone home and read for 10 minutes. Okay. All right, read with me. All brains need effective stress management strategies, as unmanaged stress is lethal to both brain and body. Effective stress management strategies are critical for females, as their brains are twice as vulnerable as male brains to many stress-related disorders. Not good or bad, right or wrong, it's just the way it is. And some of those stress-related disorders, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is one of them. Certainly clinical depression is another. And then there's a whole host of autoimmune diseases that are stress-related. So female brains are at least twice as vulnerable to those. And nobody knew the reason. You know, how is this happening? When I retired from healthcare in December of 2013. And for years before that, I worked with people who came back from Iran and Iraq and Pakistan and wherever. And some of them have PTSD. Now, certainly, fortunately, only about 20% of people in the military come back from, you know, active combat with PTSD. But then we began to notice a huge difference between males with PTSD and females with PTSD. So if a male really wants to recover and works on the strategies, you know, we'd see them having that resolved in 9 to 12 months. Not every male wants to work on it. But if you want to work on it, it can happen pretty quickly. When I left healthcare, we were still working with women who had come back 10 years earlier and were still struggling with the flashbacks and all the outcomes of PTSD. And nobody could understand the reason. So I'm going to give you the bottom line for your male brains who only want the bottom line. The bottom line is this. Research shows that males routinely underestimate the seriousness of a stressor. Females routinely overestimate the stressor. So if the male and the female brain together is the scriptural model for the most effective way to deal with life, then there's probably a reason for that. Her brain can help him realize, you know, it's a little bit worse than you think it is. And his brain can help her realize, you know, it probably is. But why don't we work together and find responses, creative brainstorming to resolve this, and then it'll be better for both of us. But when males don't understand that, because they underestimate, it's so easy for them to say, no big deal, what's your problem? Just get over it. And that in itself is a stressor. Because when the female brain is already overreactive and a male tells her it's no big deal, it is her problem, then that becomes an increased stressor. And I hear this over and over and over again when I deal with couples. She comes in and she's just hanging by her fingernails off the ceiling. And he's just kind of laid back going, I really don't know what her problem is because it's not that bad. So my mother wants to move in with us. What's the big deal? And she's just vibrating. As soon as you say, don't worry about it, what picture goes into working memory? Worrying about it. Yep, whatever your representation is, it goes into working memory and you worry about it even more. So that is unhelpful. However, researchers think they have discovered something about the male and the female brains that clearly explains this difference in response. And it's really fun. So we go to rat research. Because rats make really, really good research subjects because their brains are so much like ours. And there are people who don't want to hear that. But the next time somebody calls you a rat, say thank you. Hey, their brains and ours are very much, very, very much alike. Because the human peptides are identical to the rat peptides. And who knew? Peptides are substances that have everything to do with mood and with processing information. So read this aloud with me. Peptides are molecules consisting of two or more amino acids. Some are hormones, others are neurotransmitters, and some are a combination of both. Do you understand the significance of a substance that is both a neurotransmitter and a hormone? Up and down means yes. Okay, let me digress for a few seconds because I think this is completely huge to understanding some of this stress difference response. So here's the deal. What's a hormone? Give me an example of a hormone. Testosterone, excellent. That's a hormone. At levels of about 20 times higher in the male body than the female body. And if you're just a little bit after puberty, and playing a competitive game like soccer, football, or rugby, you probably have 40 times as much testosterone in your circulating system. I would never let my three sons go out on a one-to-one date after they'd come off a competitive game, whatever it was, because I knew their testosterone was just oozing out their pores. And it makes you more assertive, if not downright aggressive. So they could have their girlfriends over to the house, but they couldn't do one-to-one dating. Okay, so testosterone is a hormone. Estrogen's a hormone. Insulin is a hormone. And it takes just a teeny, teeny particle of that hormone, and it will affect every cell in your body. They're terribly, terribly powerful. So what's a neurotransmitter? Hello? What's a neurotransmitter? Guess if you don't. I mean, it didn't have to have the precise wording, but if you don't know, you're not going to understand this. So a neurotransmitter is exactly what it says it is. It's a substance that transmits information across that synaptic space between neurons so that this neuron can talk to that neuron, can talk to that neuron, can talk to that neuron, and that's all thinking is. Neurons talking to each other across that space. Now, there are some substances that are a combination of both, and peptides are one of those. So now you already know that when a peptide is released, it's both a hormone and a neurotransmitter, so it will impact every single cell in your brain and body. Every single neuron, every single other cell. It's just completely powerful. Remember that. So researchers decided they would study how rat brains respond to stress. And is there any difference between how the rat female brain and the male rat brain responds to stressors? The studies were reported in Molecular Psychiatry. I do have these slides on my website, so you can go there and you can get the link if you want to actually read the research, and it's pretty interesting. And this is how the abstract of that study puts it. So read this with me. In response to a stressor, the hypothalamus releases corticotropin-releasing factor, or CRF, both a peptide hormone and a neurotransmitter. So you already know that in response to the stress, here comes one of these double powerful substances. The CRF binds to receptors on cell surfaces in the locus coeruleus, an alarm center deep in the brainstem. So now you know that we are talking about two of these layers that we just mentioned earlier. One is this brain stem and cerebellum, the reptilian layer, and embedded in that brain stem is a little group of cells called the locus coeruleus. Don't need to remember the name, just know there's an alarm center in the brain stem. And the CRF, this powerful substance, immediately wants to go and find the neurons in that alarm center and alert them that something really awful is happening. So let me just give you a couple of things about how powerful this CRF is. It can suppress appetite, so that if a person is very stressed and CRF is pouring out, you don't even want to eat. And that may have some implications for anorexia nervosa. Brain is stressed, don't want to eat. It increases subjective anxiety, meaning the brain is really upset about this. It is linked with euphoric feelings that accompany alcoholism, which is one reason that some people can have a really difficult time breaking an addiction to alcohol, because the CRF gets poured out. It triggers something called inflammation. And when you study health, you know inflammation is not good. If you get a cut on your finger and it gets all red and sore and warm, that shows that the immune system is sending fighters to that injury to try to heal it. But when this happens internally, it is not good for the brain and body. And this process is being investigated in multiple sclerosis research, because now there's some sense that that may be triggered by inflammation, which follows the secretion of this CRF based on how stressed that brain is. And finally, high levels of corticotropin-releasing factor have been found in the cerebral spinal fluid of individuals who committed suicide. And I want to take just a minute to dwell on that, because we so misunderstand suicide. We think, in general, we meaning the average person, that suicide's a choice. And how could you make that choice? Let me tell you that nobody kills themselves unless their brain is in an altered state. And now we know that individuals who've killed themselves have high levels of this incredibly powerful substance all through the brain and cerebral spinal fluid. And what we believe happens is that for some reason that brain is very, very, very stressed. Something is happening that makes it really difficult for that brain to process or accept or deal with or whatever. And though that high-level concentration alters the brain, and when the person has high levels of internal emotional anxiety and it gets really bad, all they can think of is stopping the pain. And medication doesn't work, and alcohol doesn't work, and drugs don't work, and so the only thing they can think of is to kill themselves. Unfortunately, because many churches don't understand that, there are penalties to pay in terms of where you get buried. You know, my mother's family was Catholic, French Roman Catholic. And if somebody who's Catholic kills themselves, they don't get buried in the church cemetery. That's holy ground, and you can't put that body in there. And then that even makes the family feel worse. So we really need to start looking at this in a new direction. So CRF is very powerful. So here's a picture of one neuron from the locus coeruleus in the brain stem. And it is a neuron in a stressed female rat. Now, take a look at this. Do you see these blue things all around the surface of this neuron? How many are there? 7. Good. Those are what we call receptor molecules, and people get nervous about that label. I don't care what you call them. You know, think of this as a lake and there's 7 docking stations. I don't care. Make a metaphor that works for you. All that means is that there is a way for something to get into that cell. And when we're talking about the stress response, it's CRF that was generated, triggered by the hypothalamus when that brain felt stressed. So they're just docking stations that accept chemicals. So you can think of the neurotransmitter as a little boat, and it's carrying, it's not only going to dock in there and talk to the neuron, but it's carrying a bunch of CRF that's going to get dumped into that cell. And because all of these are open, we say that that cell takes the full hit of the CRF, and it becomes very stress reactive. Okay, have you got that picture? Good. Hallelujah. All right. Now, this is a neuron from the locus coeruleus in the brainstem of a male brain. And you can just see by looking at that, that it's different from the female neuron. What do you notice that's different? All right. First of all, let's look at these little green things. There are 4 of them here. In the female brain, there were only 3, and they were just sitting there, duh, not doing anything. You get to the male brain, there's 3 of them, is that what I said, in the female brain? And there's 4 in the male brain, and they're doing something. As soon as that neuron perceives a stressor, they get busy, these arrestins, and start pulling in docking stations, pulling them inside the cell so they're not available for anything to dock, neurotransmitter or hormone, and pour into the cell. So you can see that one of these is already in. This one's coming in. This one looks like it'll be pulled in next. And if they don't pull any more in, there's only 4 left instead of 7. But if it pulls another one, there'll be less than half as many. So if you only have 3 or 4 docking stations compared to 7, how much CRF is going to get in the cell? Only half as much. And this adaptation, as it's called, is completely unique to the male brain. Never seen it happen in the female brain. So the male brain has what we call toned down stress sensitivity. And so when researchers say that the male brain routinely underestimates a stressor, all it means is it's only taken in half as much as CRF and it's no big deal. And when we say that the female brain overreacts to a stressor, that's because all of those receptor molecules, docking stations, are open. They take as much CRF as is brought to it. And that tends to help them overreact to something. So there you can see the 2 of them side by side. And if you want to go and look up the actual research, you can go to my website, arlenetaylor.org, and look under stress, and you'll see this, and you can look at it. So you can see the difference comparing them side by side. It's huge. So we've got this overreactive female neuron and the underreactive male neuron, simply based on the fact that those little green arrestins did nothing in the female brain. Somebody asked me the other day, well, did they used to do something and just quit working? I don't know. We just know they're not working now. And the male brain, it's just busy pulling in those docking stations, so there's no place for a little ship to dock and unload its cargo. So Deborah Bangasser is a researcher who has spent a couple decades studying stress and the female brain. So read this slide with me. The female alarm system is more sensitive to stressors and to CRF, period. Even in the absence of stressors, The female stress signaling system is more sensitive from the start. Lack of receptor internalization in the female brain could translate into impaired ability to cope with high levels of CRF, as occurs in depression and PTSD. So now we're taking another look at the military that are returning, males and females, and how they're stressed and who's stressed and how we can work on that. The brain is absolutely, hands down, the first system, of course, to recognize a stressor. And it usually is recognized in that third layer where there's some conscious thought. And remember, your perception of a stressor and your strategies for dealing with a stressor are learned in childhood. So the hypothalamus here in that middle part, it triggers the stress response. As soon as it perceives that your brain thinks something is stressful, it'll implement the stress response. And it usually will do that for about 72 hours based on each event. And if you keep rehearsing the event, it can keep triggering the stress response. So I've worked with people who were 35, 40, 45. I don't think their brains were ever out of the stress response since they were born because of how dysfunctional the family system was. And so their habit is that they just live on cortisol and adrenaline and dopamine. And the sad part is this. The stress event can be real or it can be imagined. So what would be a real stress event? Well, for example, it was a real stress event when I was lecturing in Bakersfield and somebody called me up and said, the epicenter of a earthquake was just 3 miles from your house. Do you want me to go over and check and see if it's still standing? I said, yeah, I think that'd be a good idea. Call me back. That would be a real stress event. However, even in that, I choose now how stressed I'm going to be. But it can also be imagined. So what would imagined stress be? I'm over here in Australia and I can't sleep at night thinking about what if there was another earthquake and now I'm over here in Australia. That's an imagined event. Hasn't even occurred. You're just worried about it. It could be something like, I don't think I'm very good at math. I don't think I'm going to pass math. I think I'm going to flunk. Well, if you think you're going to flunk, you probably are. And that would be an imagined stressor. Instead of taking action to get some extra tutoring or whatever you need to do, you're imagining you're going to flunk, and so you're not going to remember much even when you do study. So stressors interact with the brain in a predictable equation. And this is the equation. Read the first paragraph with me. 20% of any negative impact to your brain and body is due to the stressor event. 80% is due to your perception of the event. And that seems to be pretty standard in the studies that have been done. Comes actually from work by Epictetus. Please note, 2nd century Greek philosopher. After a trip to Greek and I was studying about Epictetus, I put my first slide up and I said, this Epictetus character was really amazing. He was a slave and he must have been good at what he did but he didn't like being a slave, apparently. And his owner busted up one of his legs pretty badly so he couldn't walk, so he wouldn't be able to run away. So if you go to Wikipedia, for example, and look up Epictetus, you'll see a picture of him sitting at his desk with a crooked leg and his crutch. And this is what he said. It's not so much what happens that matters as what you think about what happens. And that's the perception part. And that's the reason I think the Apostle Paul says, be anxious for what? Nothing. People want to argue with me about that. Like, you know, I'm Paul's sister or something. In fact, when I came back from Greece and told some friends of mine about Epictetus, their first question was, well, did you get to meet him? No, actually, I didn't. So I tend to put second century up there now. But they'll say to me, there's some things you need to be anxious about. And I'll say, there's nothing you need to be anxious about. Nothing. Because anxiety downshifts your brain. And I know that when I was here 18 months ago, we talked about downshifting. And what downshifting simply means is your brain's energy and attention is shifted from this third conscious thought part of the brain down to the mammalian layer or to the reptilian layer. And you have lost most of your access, if not all of it, to the functions in the prefrontal cortex, which have to do with decision-making and willpower and morality and so on. You don't even have them at your fingertips. So recognizing a problem and brainstorming steps to solve it is great. Being anxious about it helps in no way whatsoever. So this is now what we call the 20-80 rule. So read this with me. Only 20% of any negative effect to brain and body is due to the effect, to the event, sorry. 80% is due to your perception of the event and the weight you give to it. Even when you can't do anything about the 20%, you can do almost everything about the 80% because you create your own perceptions. And perceptions are created here in the prefrontal cortex. So what does that mean? It means that your thoughts and your self-talk create your perceptions. I think last time I was here, I talked a little bit about Dr. Daniel Wegner and the white bear phenomenon, but that totally plays into this. He says, when you say, don't think about a white bear, a representation of whatever a white bear looks like to you will go into working memory, which is that little part, you know, in at the front of your frontal lobes, where you hold in conscious awareness whatever it is you want to think about. So a representation of that will go into your brain's working memory, and you'll likely think about it even more frequently. So if I say to you, don't think about the white bear, what are you thinking about? The white bear. And the problem with that is it tells you what I don't want you to do ineffectively, because you always will create that first picture. It's like, don't touch the stove, and the picture is touching the stove. Kid touches the stove. We spank the kid for disobeying. Who gave him an instruction that they can't follow? I mean, it's very dysfunctional. You should say, at least keep your hand away from the stove. At least the picture then is, here's the stove and here's your hand. Problem is, most of us grew up receiving negative instructions. And our brains are filled with negative instructions. So we're giving ourselves negative instructions, and we're giving others, especially children, negative instructions, and then punishing them because they don't know what to do. Because if I don't want you to think about a white bear, what do I want you to think about? Well, you don't know. I haven't told you what to think about, only told you what I don't want you to think about. And it's critical to understand that we need to start telling ourselves only what to do, tell others what to do, and stop talking about what not to do. And we did not know that. So he goes on to talk about willpower. And let's talk just a little bit about that before we finish up, because people totally misunderstand willpower. So willpower is a function of the prefrontal cortex. And you don't get much done in life without willpower. Problem is that prefrontal cortex right behind your forehead isn't done until mid to late 20s. As a preacher's kid, I used to wonder, how in the world? What happened that Christ didn't start his earthly ministry till he was 30? Look how much time he wasted. If he'd just gotten on the ball and started when he was 20, imagine what he could have accomplished. You know, and that's the incomplete teenage brain, not even thinking right itself. Because the temptations and trials he had to deal with really required a done brain in order to accomplish them. And it's not done until at least late 20s. And, you know, I've met people 50, 60, 70 that I'm not sure that prefrontal cortex ever got done. You know, they didn't have anybody to help them learn how to develop brain function. You know, you want to start teaching kids to make choices really, really early in life. You only ever give them two choices at a time, because you only have two hemispheres. If you give them more than two, the brain will just drop out everything above two, and it might actually drop out your best option. So we need to start giving, and for some adults who don't know how to make decisions, they need to start practicing just like a two-year-old. So you would put, for example, a plate on the table, and you would put two spoons, one on each side of the plate. And you'd say to the child, pick a spoon. Which spoon do you want to use? Okay, some ambidextrous might pick them both up, but usually they'll pick up just one. And it doesn't matter. But you're having them make a choice, and then you take away whichever one they didn't choose. Or you'll say to a three-year-old, what shirt do you want to wear, the red one or the blue checked one? And you don't care. But get them to make a choice, and then you take away the other one. Because not only are you teaching them to make a choice, you want them to know there's a consequence for the choice they make. If they don't learn that, they'll never be successful. I'm at the park not too long ago. I was visiting friends, and we went to the park for lunch. At the picnic table next to us, there was a woman with about eight little kids, little boys, probably ranging in age somewhere between 7 and 9, and each one of them had a skateboard. And they got into kind of a ruckus at lunch. I couldn't help but overhearing. And so my assessment is this. It was her boy's birthday. One of those little kids was her boy. I figured that out after a while. And so she must have said to him, on your birthday, you can have some friends over for a party. Where do you want to go? You can go to the skateboard park, or you can go to the zoo. And he must have said skateboard park, because here they all were at the skateboard park, and they'd already been using their skateboards for probably several hours, and now they were eating lunch. And so little Farquhart, her kid, says, I don't want to do skateboarding after lunch. It's boring now. And his mother, instead of saying, that was the choice you made for your birthday, now you have two choices. You can stay here longer with a skateboard, or we can go home. Pick one. That's the healthy way to deal with that. Instead, she said, well, what do you want to do? I want to go to the zoo. What do you suppose she said? Okay, help me pick up lunch and we'll go to the zoo. We'll have a few hours at the zoo. She has taught that kid that he can have everything if he whines and creates a ruckus. The choice is no big deal because he can get her to give him the other choice as well. That's unhelpful in life. So you need to start giving choices early, and they need to experience the consequences of that choice, good, bad, or indifferent. So Daniel Wegner says, willpower is the energetic determination to carry out your plans, decisions, or goals. It is a function of that prefrontal cortex. And again, I'm hoping that you grew up making decisions and experiencing the results of those decisions. He says, brains are not, you know the word not? Brains are not designed to stop bad habits using willpower. That's a very scary thought, because most people don't understand that. So he goes on to say, and read this with me, willpower rarely works well in depriving yourself of something you already do to receive gratification, such as ending an undesirable habit. Willing yourself not to do something puts the thing you don't want to do in working memory. Brain constantly thinks about it, and it usually increases the behavior. So we learned this in the years of working with addictive behaviors. If you say to somebody, don't take a drink of alcohol today, what goes into working memory? And that's all the person wants to do. If you say, don't smoke today, a picture of smoking goes where? In working memory, and they want to rush right out and get a pack of cigarettes. So it does not work. And it goes back to the white bear phenomenon. So you only tell yourself what you do want to have happen. And you tell others what you do want to have happen. You know, I said, don't think about a white bear. What are you supposed to think about? You have no idea. I was talking to a group of freshmen at a university, and I asked that question. Somebody said, if you don't want me to think about a white bear, then you probably want me to think about a brown bear. And somebody else said, well, what makes you think she even wants you to think about a bear? Well, I don't know. You don't know. And so it's very, very unhelpful. So willpower is designed to help you persevere in developing a brand new behavior, something you've never done before, and replacing an old behavior with healthier, more functional ones. So Dr. Wegner says, what you think and what you say to yourself impact what you do. Because typically you end up doing what you think and talk about. And how you say it impacts your success. I don't know if I put another slide on there. Let me just enlarge on this a bit. Interesting studies done recently, just this last month, on how you say something to yourself and how that impacts your success, and it's huge. So they took a group of people, and they put a 2x4 across the room, up off the floor a bit with some nice padding around it. And they took people of different ages, and they said, all right, your job is to walk from one end of the 2x4 to the other and stay up on the 2x4. And then they had a peanut gallery who were chanting for the first group, don't fall off the 2x4, don't fall off, whatever you do, don't fall off. And what happened? Most of them fell off. 85% of the 100 fell off. Because when you say don't fall off the 2x4, what's the picture? Falling off the 2x4. And that's what they think, you know, killed that high wire, the Walenda tightrope walker in that family, because he came home one day and he said to his wife, and he was really gifted, he said, you know, I was up on the tightrope wire today, and he said, I saw in my mind myself falling to the ground. He said, I've never thought about that before. Well, that's really not what a tight, you know, high wire rope, wire walker wants to think about. But they didn't understand this, and so he kept saying to his wife, I keep seeing myself falling off the wire. And about 3 months later, he was up doing a high wire routine, and he followed through on that picture and fell off and died. So it makes a difference. So then they took the same group several weeks later. Here's the 2x4. They said, okay, we want you to do the same thing. Step on the 2x4. We want you to walk clear to the end and stay up on the 2x4. And this time they had a group of people chanting, put your arms out, balance, you are walking the 2x4. And what happened? 85% of them walked the 2x4. So apparently, in the studies that have been done, nothing's ever quite 100%. You know, 85% fell off, 85% stayed on, depending on what was being said and the pictures they created in their brain. So somebody said to me the other day, well, 85% isn't 100. And I said, no, but it beats 15. You know, it gives you an advantage. So then they started talking about, well, then what do you say to yourself? I am staying up on the 2x4. And they tried that. And it wasn't as successful as they thought it would be. So they talked to Dr. Wegner, and he goes, you know, there's some new research coming out, and I'm going to put some of that on my website when I get back home so you can actually have it, that when you say, I am doing something, that kicks into your self-esteem levels. And it personalizes it. And if you are fearful about something, then it's probably not going to help that much. And the current research is this. You talk to yourself as if you were talking to your brain, which is what you're doing anyway. But you make sure that your brain knows who you're talking about. You know, because if I look at Dr. French and say, you are something, I'm not talking to my brain. And it's not going to help me walk the 2x4 if I tell him you are walking the 2x4 successfully. So the research says that you state your given name and then say you and tell your brain what you want it to do as if it's a done deal. So if I were walking the 2x4, I would say, Arlene, you are walking the 2x4 successfully from one end to the other. And that depersonalizes a little bit from your own levels of self-esteem, and people get, it's just more effective. So they took hundreds of students and said, you have 5 minutes to prepare a 5-minute speech. And they divided them into groups. And one of the groups, they said, you say to yourself, I am giving a good speech. And the other group, you say to them yourself, using your name and you, Arlene, you are doing an effective speech. It's going well. And then they brought in independent speech observers, if you will, to evaluate how the speeches went. And hands down, the group that had said, I'm doing a good speech, did a speech that wasn't nearly as effective as the ones who said, Arlene, you are doing a good speech. That was piece one. Piece two was, the ones who have said, I am doing this, did a whole lot more post-speech negativity. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. I should have said that. Oh, I didn't do very well. That's really too bad. There was a whole bunch of negativity and post-speech self-talk that was unhelpful. The ones who had said, Arlene, you're doing a good speech for 5 minutes of preparation. Very little post-speech negativity. Very little beating themselves up. And researchers are saying this is what teachers need to teach kids to do starting in kindergarten. Because it's going to make a huge difference to their level of success as they get older. But who knew? When you go to Paul's writings, you remember that he listed a bunch of things that we were supposed to think about. Do you remember that list? So what were some of them? Lovely, pure, good, of good report, on and on and on. How many of them in his list were negative? None. Not one. And I just don't know how we've missed the boat with this, because the Bible is a manual for everyday living. Be anxious about nothing means exactly that. Be anxious about nothing. Thinking thoughts and talking to yourself and talking to others. The Bible is really clear. All positive. And that goes back to Daniel Wegner. Don't is not a positive. Don't just tells you what you don't want the person to do. It does not tell them what to do. So I'm working diligently on this, because as a preacher's kid, boy, I think I could count on one hand the times that I received positive instructions. You know, my parents did the best they could, but they didn't know anything about this, and they'd always been told, don't, so that's all I got. Besides that, I don't care how big the congregation was. I mean, 500 members in my dad's church, every one of them knew exactly how the preacher's daughter ought to behave. Problem was that none of them agreed. So I would have 500 don'ts, in effect. So my brain was filled with don'ts. Unhelpful. So I'm working very diligently every time I get a negative thought, every time I hear myself say, oh, Arlene, don't do that, I catch myself and change it to a positive and tell my brain, Arlene, you are, and then what I want to have done, not what I don't want to have done. Have you got it? If you will go and put that into practice, you won't know yourself in a year. So God bless you as you do that, because it's worth the work.